Okay, well, thanks, Anthony. Thank you all for coming. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. So what I'd like to talk to you about is basically mostly based on this paper from last April with Ning Bao, Charles Cao, and Cindy Keeler. Though, as you can tell, we sort of are working on various generalizations and extensions. And I'll throw in a little bit of stuff on this other paper with Netta Engelhardt from around the same time. Okay, so I'll start with a question that I imagine, given that this is PI, most people are interested in, which is quantum gravity. So we know that the nice classical description of gravity that we have thanks to Einstein's theory of general relativity must be some approximation that emerges in some low energy limit of some more fundamental theory of quantum gravity. I think this is not contentious in this audience. One of the sort of holy grail questions in theoretical physics is understanding how this low energy limit comes out of whatever this more fundamental theory is. Now, there are many reasons this question is an ambitious one and a hard one, not least of which is that we don't even understand or don't even know what this underlying microscopic quantum theory even is. Now, I realize there are many sort of models and ideas for such theories, especially here at PI. And one of these is the so-called ADS-CFT correspondence, which among its many, many uses, gives us a framework for making this question and sort of related ones much more tractable. And the reason it does so is that it tells us that we have a definition of such a theory of quantum gravity in terms of something familiar, which is namely just ordinary quantum field theory. Now, what's the statement? I'm sure you've all seen this before, but here's sort of the usual spiel that you can say to sound fancy, which is that some non-perturbative, background-independent theory of quantum gravity with some asymptotically ADS boundary conditions is supposed to be dual to some conformal field theory living on the boundary of this bulk. Okay, now that's a lot of words and sort of it's a nice general statement, but still a little bit too general to make progress. So what we often do is we work in some appropriate limit where the bulk theory looks classical or around a limit in which bulk theory looks classical. That is to say, when the CFT has large central charge and strong coupling, all the usual words. And then the pictures we often draw are sort of the duality between the cylinders. You have some CFT living on the boundary of the cylinder, which is the Einstein static universe here, which is supposed to be dual to some theory which is well approximated by Einstein gravity living in the interior of the cylinder in this ADS space. Okay. Now, how does this help us? Well, it basically tells us that if we're trying to understand how classical or semi-classical gravity emerges from some underlying theory, then if ADS-CFT tells me that whatever the underlying theory is really is the boundary field theory, the CFT, then the question I should be asking in this context of ADS-CFT is how this geometric bulk, or the semi-classical bulk, emerges from whatever the field theoretic degrees of freedom are. And those in principle we know. We understand in principle how to deal with non-gravitational field theories. Okay. Now, answering this question, although it's much more tractable now, requires understanding what this word dual means in the duality. In other words, what is the holographic dictionary that tells me how to translate from the field theoretic language of the boundary into the gravitational language of the bulk and vice versa? Now, in fact, this vice versa direction we've understood fairly well for a long time, since basically the early days of ADS-CFT. So for example, one of the standard things you say is the so-called extrapolate dictionary, which says that, well, for every operator you have in your CFT, there's some dual bulk field, and the asymptotic behavior of these fields in the bulk is supposed to give you the one-point functions and sources of these operators in the CFT. What I'm interested in is what's called bulk reconstruction, which is going in the other direction, in recovering bulk physics from the boundary field theory. This is a lot harder. And so the way I sort of visualize this chain of questions is as follows. So here's, again, the very ambitious general question that I started with. And then the framework of ADS-CFT tells us that if we want to start making tractable progress on this question, the question we should be asking is how the field theoretic degrees of freedom rearrange themselves to look like something, or look like gravity. And then when we work in this nice limit, or work around this nice limit of ADS-CFT, where the bulk is well approximated by Einstein gravity, the question becomes, how does this geometric theory of gravity emerge from the boundary field theory? And in fact, you can make things even easier on yourself, which is how sort of most of the progress in this field has come about over the past, I guess, 2 decades now, which is to say, let me not even worry too much about the emergence of the bulk geometry. Let me work in a limit where I'm just doing bulk quantum field theory on some fixed background. So for example, say I fix the bulk geometry to be pure ADS space or some black hole or whatever. And let me ask, how are bulk matter field operators on some fixed background geometry recovered from the boundary field theory? Okay, this is sort of the most restricted question you can ask. And for that reason, it's the one on which we've made the most progress. And so while ultimately my goal is to start moving up in this flowchart, it's useful to review what we know about this latter question. So let me do that in just a couple of slides. Okay. So the sort of first progress in this direction is this so-called HKLL reconstruction, which basically says, well, I know that boundary operators I can recover from the asymptotics of bulk fields dual to them. And in working in the semi-classical limit, I know that these bulk fields obey some classical equations of motion. So for example, I like to just think of some Klein-Gordon field in the bulk, and that obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. That's nice and simple. So if knowing the sort of one-point functions of all operators in my CFT tells me the asymptotics of this bulk field, could I not formally integrate in these bulk equations of motion to recover this bulk field anywhere I'd like? And indeed, the answer is yes, in some appropriate sense. So here's my boundary operator O, here's my bulk field phi, and what HKLL showed, at least working in pure ADS, but you can do this a bit more generally, is that there's some boundary to bulk Green's function that you can construct from the bulk equations of motion of this field, which when you smear against these boundary operators, recovers for you this bulk field at some point in the bulk. And the smearing has non-trivial support only over some portion of the boundary. So here, for example, if this is my bulk point X where I want to recover my field phi, then I can recover phi here just from the one-point functions of boundary operators on the set of all points space-like separated from X, which is what I've drawn here. But in fact, I have more freedom in choosing this region D. So for example, this reconstruction I've drawn here is the global reconstruction. There's this so-called Rindler wedge reconstruction I can do, where I say instead of taking D to be some strip of the boundary like this, I'll take D to be some causal diamond. Oh, yeah, Alex.
Sorry, was that an operator equation or just?
Good, yeah. So I was being sloppy with my wording. I want to think of this as an operator equation, but when you treat phi as some classical bulk field, really you should take the expectation value of its own. Then. Yeah, good question. Okay, so in this Rindler wedge reconstruction, I instead take D to be some causal diamond of the boundary, and then I consider the set of all points in the bulk that are causally related to D in both the past and the future. So this is some wedge of the cylinder that's the intersection of the past and future of this boundary region D. And it turns out you can find some appropriate smearing kernel, which recovers for you operators anywhere inside this wedge just from boundary operators in this sort of restricted domain D, okay? And this was one of the first hints at what we now call subregion-subregion duality in ADS-CFT, which is this idea that if I give you only some restricted subset of information in the boundary associated to some subregion, some spatial subregion of the boundary, the restricted information in the bulk that I can recover likewise corresponds to some subregion of the bulk. So in particular, in this picture, you'd say, well, the CFT data on this boundary diamond D is, in some sense, a dual to the bulk data in this sort of causal wedge, it's Rindler diamond. Okay. In fact, this idea of subregion-subregion duality, we now understand, is indeed correct. Oh, yeah, question.
So is it true that in the CFT, the one-point function of a local operator is zero?
No. In vacuum, it is. Well, depending on what your operator is. But if I consider some more excited state, that need not be the case. And indeed, if I were to treat this as an operator equation, so I sort of think of this phi as some quantum field in the bulk, then I don't have to worry about taking these expectation values. Good. Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
I think in QFT, there's a theorem saying if you know the quantum field enough about its value in some small region, then you can actually reconstruct the whole theory.
Sorry, if you know a quantum field in some small region.
Sorry, I don't remember the precise statement of the theory.
I'm not sure I know what this this theorem is that you're referring to. I don't know if someone else does. But, okay, then we can chat about it later, I guess. Okay, so this idea of subregion-subregion duality, we now understand is correct, at least in some appropriate sense. But the sort of final proof that of its correctness doesn't come from this sort of causal-based reconstruction, where you consider some equations of motion in the bulk, but from considering entanglement entropy in this holographic context. Okay. Now, I'm sure many, if not all of you, are familiar with this idea, but here's sort of the mandatory slide with all of the relevant equations and acronyms and names, which is this so-called HRT formula. So the framework is the following. So here I'm imagining my CFT on some plane. Say I have some state of my field theory, rho, and say I identify some spatial subregion of some time slice. So here R is some portion of some, say, t equals 0 slice. Then what I can do is I can construct some reduced state associated to the subregion by just taking my full state and tracing out any degrees of freedom outside. So R bar here is the complement of R, which is anything outside of this region R. So there's some reduced state on this region R. And then I could consider this object, this von Neumann entropy, computed from this reduced state. And this gives me what's called the entanglement entropy. And what the HRT formula says is that when this field theory state is dual to some classical geometry that obeys Einstein's equations, this very complicated object, which in general is very intractable to compute purely using field theoretic means, geometrizes and becomes something very simple. You compute it by just finding, here I'll draw it here, some surface in the bulk anchored on the boundary of this region R, which is extremal, which means that its area remains unchanged to linear order if I wiggle it slightly. I take the area of that surface. If there are multiple such surfaces, I take the one with minimal area, and a quarter of its area in Planck units computes for me this this entanglement entropy. Yes?
This is still the Brom approximation? Like, which geometry are we supposed to use? Are we supposed to use the classical background, or are we supposed to use, like, the geometry with quantum corrections?
Good. For now, let's just use the classical background, and I'll refer to quantum corrections when I get to this dot here.
Question.
Yeah, of course.
Is that supposed to be an equality or approximately?
Add plus order h bar to the zero. And I'll say what those terms are again in this section down here. So yeah, so this is strictly to leading order in GH bar. Good. And of course, you should all recognize this formula. This is just the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy formula for the entropy of a black hole. And in particular, if my CFT is in a thermal state, its dual geometry is some static black hole, some black hole background. And if I use this formula to compute the sort of thermal entropy of the full CFT state, it would tell me that the surface X to bar is just the horizon of the black hole, and I just get a quarter of the area of the black hole in Planck units. So everything's consistent with what we know about black hole thermodynamics. Okay. Now, why does this tell us about bulk reconstruction, or what does it tell us about bulk reconstruction? Well, the surface X sub R is generically space-like separated from this region R. So in the picture I had a couple slides ago where I was imagining this sort of causal wedge that you generate by just looking at points that are causally separated from R, or from the boundary causal diamond associated to R, it seems like the surface is sensitive to more of the bulk than you might have naively expected just from, say, integrating in some hyperbolic equations of motion, which is what this HKLL prescription did. And so the portion of the bulk you should be able to recover is more than you would naively expect it from just this causal structure picture I had earlier. And in fact, it turns out that if you use ideas from quantum error correction, it's now been shown that this surface tells you precisely how far into the bulk you're able to probe from some particular boundary subregion. So the statement in particular is that if I, so let me consider this region R, and let me consider this HRT service X. From this HRT service X, let me fire null GOD6 towards R. This generates for me some wedge, which I've drawn terribly, I apologize, which is the so-called entanglement wedge defined by the surface and this boundary region. The statement is that any operator, any bulk operator, contained in this entanglement wedge, I can represent in terms of the operator algebra of the boundary, just restricted to this boundary diamond. Yeah.
So why do you need more than the causal wedge? Is it a very long explanation?
It's not that you need more than the causal wedge. It's that you're clearly sensitive to more than the causal wedge, right? So if I draw this picture again, I don't know how well you can see this. So here's this picture. So here's my boundary causal diamond. Here's the causal wedge that I get. Goes however far deep it goes. This HRT surface is out here somewhere. Now, the area of this HRT surface computes for me this entanglement entropy, which I can compute just from the reduced state in this boundary diamond. So clearly, there's something in this boundary diamond that's sensitive to something outside of just this region that I would have naively thought is causally accessible from the boundary. And in fact, this isn't surprising. This HKLL argument for reconstructing operators in the causal wedge basically just says take boundary one-point functions, integrate in the equations of motion, and that gives me some bulk operators. That's true, and in fact, that does work generically. But you have access to far more information in the boundary than just one-point functions. You have access to all endpoint functions you like. You have access to all entanglement entropy or all entropies you like. And so it makes sense that there's more of the bulk you should recover than just what you would have thought from one-point functions if you have access to everything in the state in this region. And so it's not surprising that you can get more than just this causal wedge. Good. So this statement is basically the state of the art of what's known about bulk reconstruction in this probe limit that I mentioned. So I'm fixing where I fix the background. Now what I'm interested in, as someone trained as a relativist, is probing the geometry, not just fields on some fixed geometry. Okay. And so how am I supposed to do that? Right. So how do I now move from this, this bottom question up past this probe limit and start actually probing gravity? Okay. So that's what I want to talk about. Now, it's clear, and it's been clear since the HRT and the RT formulas were first formulated, that there's some deep connection between the entanglement structure of the boundary and bulk geometry, right? That's literally what the HRT formula says. Entanglement equals some geometric object, okay? And moreover, the fact that this formula plays some key role in bulk reconstruction in this probe limit, when I'm just interested in bulk operators, suggests for me that it should also play some important role in recovering the geometry. And the question is, does it? Now, this is certainly not a new question. So Mark van Ramsdonk has had this tagline, entanglement builds geometry, arguing precisely this idea. And indeed, we've had plenty of partial results in sort of this general direction. So for example, if I were interested not in reconstructing any particular geometry, but sort of recovering particular properties of geometry in general, then I could say, well, okay, I have some geometry in the bulk. If I'm interested in gravity, this geometry should have some dynamics. How can I recover the dynamics of this geometry from the boundary? Does entanglement tell me how to do that? And the answer is yes. So at least if you're looking at states which are perturbatively close to the vacuum, this HRT formula implies that this bulk geometry, when treated perturbatively about purity S, must obey the perturbative Einstein equations. This was a whole line of research by a bunch of people. I couldn't list them all. So this is sort of a, if you'd like, a consistency check on the HRT formula telling me that HRT holds if and only if the bulk is Einstein or obeys Einstein equations. Okay. I might instead be interested in something like gravitational thermodynamics. So in gravity, we know that area laws, or we expect that area laws, are telling us something important about sort of the fundamental theory. So for example, you're all familiar with the black hole or the Hawking area law for the event horizons of black holes, that their area is non-decreasing. It turns out you can relate these area laws to entropy in the boundary. So for example, if you restrict to some subset of states that fix some portion of the bulk geometry, which in some appropriate sense basically restricts you to some set of boundary states with some fixed one-point functions, it turns out you can relate this process of coarse graining to states that fix fewer and fewer of these constraints to area laws in the bulk, which are basically area laws along apparent horizons. These are local versions of the event horizons of black holes. So this is the Engelhardt wall area law or construction. Or you could say, well, I know that I have like entropic monotonicity theorems, at least in the right number of dimensions. So if I have a 2D CFT, there's this Cassini-Huerta entropic C theorem that finds for me a C function constructor from entanglement, which is monotonic due to general properties of entanglement entropy. And it turns out you can relate that monotonicity, like entropic monotonicity property in the boundary to area laws in the bulk, including some mixed signature area laws that seem to have relevance to the early time dynamics of black holes from collapse. You can show that these area laws in certain contexts reproduce for you something like the Hawking area law along a newly formed black hole.
Question.
Yes.
Are you going to talk about whether you can probe inside the horizon?
I'll mention that, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Good. Or you could say, well, OK, maybe I am really interested in trying to recover some properties of the bulk geometry. And maybe I don't want to use entropy. And instead, I just want this to do something more more natural, I guess, in some sense, and look at the causal structure. It turns out that in this series of papers by Netta Engelhardt and Gary Horowitz, you can show that the singularity structure of boundary one-point functions, or sorry, of boundary correlators, boundary endpoint functions, you can use to reconstruct the causal structure of the bulk. So that's basically the bulk geometry up to some overall factor in the causal wedge. So in the portion of the bulk that's causally accessible to the boundary from both the future and the past. So this is some sort of partial bulk reconstruction that, again, coarse grains something. And like the main point I'm trying to make here is not to tell you the details of any of these constructions, but to point out that we have plenty of partial results that recover aspects of the bulk, whether that be the metric up to some factor, whether that be certain dynamical or thermodynamic properties of the bulk, but nothing that recovers the bulk completely for me, the bulk geometry completely. Okay, so that's what I want to do now. Okay, so I'm interested in the sort of most fine-grained question of asking, well, if HRT tells me that entanglement and geometry are related, does knowing the entanglement entropies of arbitrary regions in the boundary fix for me the bulk geometry? Okay, and if it does, how does that happen? Now, okay, the obvious answer is no, not completely, because we know that generically these HRT surfaces don't probe every possible portion of the bulk. There are generically these regions called entanglement shadows where HRT surfaces don't reach. The region very close to, say, a black hole singularity isn't probed by HRT surfaces. So generically, you should not expect that knowing all entanglement entropies gives me the full geometry. But the general expectation has been that this entanglement entropy should be able to recover the geometry wherever HRT surfaces reach. That's a reasonable expectation. But it's never been understood in detail. We don't know how that works, or we've never even confirmed that it does work. Okay. And so what I want to tell you, or the purpose of this talk, is to tell you, yes, that is correct. It does work. And it works in a sort of very nice way that makes a nice connection to a whole field of mathematics. Okay. So let me just tell you what the statement is without going into any more details. So I'll work in the following context. So I'll consider some general bulk geometry M, which is 4-dimensional or greater. And to make my life easy, I'll assume that its boundary is some finite boundary in the sense that it's a finite proper distance away from any point in the bulk. So it's not like the asymptotic boundary of ADS. This is just a simplification. If you'd like, you can imagine working in ADS CFT and in holographic renormalization, you sort of cut off the boundary to regulate any divergences. You can imagine this boundary that I'm considering to be one of these cutoff boundaries. But that's not a particularly substantial simplification. And then what I'll do is I'll assume that there's some portion of the bulk geometry, let's call it R, which is foliated by some family of two-dimensional extremal surfaces. These are two-dimensional. And because they foliate some codimension is zero region of the bulk, that means that it has to be a D minus two parameter family. So let me sort of label these surfaces by these D minus two parameters lambda. Okay, these are all anchored to the boundary. And for simplicity, I'll take them to be planar in the sense that you can sort of deform them to live in a plane. Just a topological requirement, okay? So under this set of assumptions, here I'm sketching a general picture of what this might look like. So here's a family of surfaces where I'm suppressing one dimension, so these are really all two-dimensional. And you can see that there's some sort of tubular region of the bulk in this little arch region that's being foliated by them, okay?
Sorry, can I?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
D minus two parameters or D minus two dimensional extremal surfaces?
Sorry, they're two dimensional surfaces.
So these aren't HRT surfaces.
They're HRT surfaces in four bulk dimensions.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I should have advertised maybe. It's easy to make the statement in general bulk dimension as long as the surfaces are two dimensional. So I'll make the statement there, but then the holographic interest is indeed the four bulk dimensions. And I'll point that out explicitly later on, so I'll remind you of that. Yeah, good.
How far does it look to generalize to D minus two?
Very. Yeah, so I'll tell you in one or two slides why. Yeah. Good. So under these assumptions, the statement is that the geometry in this region R, foliated by the surfaces, is uniquely fixed as long as I know the boundary metric and extrinsic curvature, as long as I know these boundary curves on which these surfaces are anchored, and as long as I know how the areas of these surfaces vary as I deform their boundaries arbitrarily. Okay. Now, the way this works is via a very nice connection to this field of mathematics called inverse boundary value problems. And indeed, we were sort of inspired by this, this result by these mathematicians who looked at a Riemannian lower dimensional version of this question. And this field of inverse boundary value problems, in fact, we're familiar with in many contexts in physics. It's what you use whenever you're trying to reconstruct the interior of some object from measurements on its boundary. So whether this be some medical imaging where you're trying to reconstruct the interior of some image of the interior of some human body, or geophysics where you use measurements on the surface of the Earth to reconstruct the interior of the Earth, the techniques we use sort of fall in the same rough field of math, which is pretty cool. And it makes sense. I mean, what we're essentially trying to do is we're trying to image the bulk from entanglement. So it's not too surprising. Okay. And so I don't want to go into too many details on how the argument works. I just want to point out sort of the key concepts. So here I'll just briefly outline what the four main steps are. And then I'll tell you just the salient features of each one. Okay. So the first thing we'll do is we'll introduce some fiducial coordinate system. In this foliation, these lambda parameters, which label the surfaces for me, are perfectly good coordinates because by the foliation assumption. And then because these surfaces are two-dimensional, I can introduce some conformally flat coordinates on each surface. So the metric on each surface is just some overall conformal factor times the flat metric. And so the remaining degree of freedom for the induced metric on each surface is just captured by this, this one free field phi. Okay. And this is the step that makes things hard in going to higher dimensions because we use the fact that we can introduce this coordinate system very implicitly. And then once I've done that, it's a pretty straightforward process. I say, well, I have some fiducial coordinate system. I'm trying to recover the geometry. Let me just recover the components of the metric in this coordinate system. And that's precisely what you do. So these the sort of lambda-lambda coordinate or components of the metric, which basically tell me about the metric components normal to these surfaces, because these lambda index directions normal to my surfaces, are fixed, or you can show are fixed, by basically deriving some elliptic inverse boundary value problem for each of these surfaces. And this is indeed sort of the whole heart of the argument. Once you've done that, the mixed components that sort of combine the normal and tangent directions to these surfaces, you can probe by just saying, well, these are also mixed these two directions. I can just take my foliation, I can deform it slightly. So in short, I'm tilting all these surfaces. What you find is that when you perform this tilt or this deformation, these metric components obey some algebraic system of equations, of linear equations, with some known coefficients. And then you just simply show that the system is invertible and you can recover these metric components. And then my one remaining degree of freedom, which was this conformal factor on each surface, you can show must obey some hyperbolic equation from or imposed by the requirement that these surfaces be extremal. And hyperbolic equations have unique solutions as long as you specify a unique initial data. And so that fixes for you this, this conformal factor you need. Okay, so that's sort of the rough structure of the argument. And now let me tell you how the connection to inverse boundary value problems comes about.
Can I ask a quick question?
Of course. Yeah.
Are you claiming that all of these equations have unique solutions? Because I would have thought there's maybe some residual gauge symmetry in like reparameterizing the foliation or different.
Good. Yeah. Good. So these coordinates are fixed uniquely from the boundary. So for example, these lambdas also label for me these sort of curves on the boundary where all the surfaces are anchored. So that fixes for me that residual freedom. And then I won't talk about it too much now, although you can ask if you're interested. There is a much more annoying and complicated way to sort of fiducially fix these isothermal coordinates as well. So these are coordinates that you can fix completely just from the boundary. Good. Okay, so the key connection to inverse boundary value problems is through this so-called Jacobi operator, or if you're a mathematician, I guess you call it the stability operator, which comes from trying to understand precisely how to talk about deformations of surfaces, extremal surfaces specifically. So just to introduce it to you, let's say I have some one-parameter family of surfaces. For now, I don't care what their dimension is, I don't care what their signature is, I don't care what the dimension of the ambient spacetime is. This is totally general. Well, what does it mean to have such a one-parameter family? Well, it means I have some starting surface, and then some map from the starting surface to each subsequent surface in my family, which in particular means that if I take some point on my starting surface, that's mapped to a point on every subsequent surface, which defines for me some curve through this family. And I can define some tangent vector to this curve on my initial surface. And this is what's called the deviation vector of this foliation. And it basically encodes for me a precise notion of the infinitesimal deformation of my starting surface. It's basically a linear fluctuation of my starting surface. And in fact, we're all familiar with at least a special case of this picture in the context of tidal forces in GR. So you may, if you've taken a GR course, you must have seen the equations of geodesic deviation, which tells me that if I consider some family of geodesics, so let's say all these surfaces are actually one-dimensional, they're just geodesics, and they're all extremal, which is what it means for them to be geodesics, this deviation vector obeys some equation that tells me that its second derivative along the curves is basically constrained by some appropriate components of the Riemann tensor. Right? Now, this deviation vector I'm supposed to interpret as some infinitesimal deviation between two adjacent surfaces or two nearby surfaces. So this second derivative is basically the relative acceleration of two nearby geodesics. That's exactly what tidal forces are in gravity. And so this is just saying that tidal forces are controlled by the Riemann tensor. So this is something familiar. It shouldn't surprise you then that if I consider surfaces that are higher dimensional and extremal, well, I get something that looks the same, just a little bit more general. So my second derivative becomes some Laplacian. So this is d squared is just the Laplacian on my initial surface. I still have some appropriate sort of components of the Riemann tensor. So here, P and sigma are just projectors, normal and tangent to my starting surface. And then extremal surfaces that are higher than one dimensional can have some non-zero extrinsic curvature. So we get some extra curvature term from that extrinsic curvature. I don't really care about those details. In fact, let me call these all Q. Okay. So this defines for me some equation that this deviation vector must obey on my starting surface in order to describe some infinitesimal deformation through a family of extremal surfaces. Okay. and I'll call this operator J for Jacobi operator. Okay? Good. Now, why is this useful? Well, it turns out I can exchange part of the boundary data I was assuming I had, in particular these area variations, with some type of information about this Jacobi operator, in particular properties of it, behavior of its solutions on the boundary. And what do I mean by that? Well, let's say I consider the Jacobi operator on some surface sigma, and I want to consider some area variations of the surface. So to do that precisely, what I'm going to do is I'll extend this surface to some arbitrary two-parameter family of extremal surfaces. I can do this however I like, except I'll just take sort of the 0, 0 surface to be my starting surface. This is a two-parameter family of extremal surfaces. I can identify some deviation vector associated to each of these parameters, essentially. Then if you just go through a pretty straightforward calculation, you can compute this mixed partial derivative of the area functional of this family of surfaces, evaluated on my starting surface. Now, because these are extremal surfaces, this, this second partial derivative just reduces to some boundary term. And you can show that it's just a bunch of stuff that is easily expressible in terms of known boundary data, so like the boundary metric, the boundary extrinsic curvature, and so on, plus this object here, which is just the contraction of one of these deviation vectors with the normal derivative of another one. So this dn is the normal derivative on sigma, normal to this boundary partial sigma. Okay. And now the point is that I can choose the behavior of these deviation vectors arbitrarily at the boundary. Right? I can just choose whatever deformation I want on the boundary, and then the bulk surface just is whatever it has to be extremal and anchored to that boundary deformation. And so what that tells me is that if I know these second area variations for any such deformation, which is what I assumed I knew, I get what's called the Dirichlet-Neumann map of J. In other words, I get the map that tells me, hey, if I give you this deformation of the boundary, here's what its normal derivative is in order for it to satisfy the Jacobi equation. Okay? So I've basically replaced this area variation data with this information about the Jacobi operator. And now I'm gold because it turns out this is the object that mathematicians use in these inverse boundary value problems to show you this. Okay? And here's how you do that, very simply. Okay? So there's this statement that says, say I have some Riemann surface, and I'm considering some normal bundle or some vector bundle on this Riemann surface. And let me consider two operators, d1 squared plus q1, d2 squared plus q2. Where d1 and d2 are just two covariant derivative operators. Q1 and q2 are some matrix valued potentials. They're in principle completely arbitrary and different. If these two operators on the same Riemann surface have the same Dirichlet-Neumann map, in other words, the same object psi, then the statement proven by these mathematicians is that these two derivative operators and these two potentials have to be the same up to a choice of gauge on this normal bundle, or on this vector bundle, okay? And now you should immediately recognize that this operator, or these operators, are exactly of the form of the Jacobi operator. So I can immediately apply this result. I know that the Dirichlet-Neumann map is fixed by area variations, and therefore the Jacobi operator of each of these surfaces is fixed by knowing their area variations up to this choice of basis on the normal bundle of the surface. Okay. And now just a couple of lines to show that this fixes for me the normal metric components. Because remember, here I'm considering some foliation of surfaces that are all extremal. And that defines for me my coordinate system. That means that these coordinate basis vectors, the d lambda i's, are just deviation vectors along some family of extremal surfaces. That means they have to satisfy the Jacobi equation. I can then use that to remove this residual gauge freedom by requiring that, their components in some preferred gauge just be Kronecker deltas. What that tells me is that this preferred gauge must just be the basis of coordinate one forms associated with these coordinates. And then once I'm working in this sort of preferred gauge, well, this theorem tells me that I can recover this derivative operator. But metric compatibility tells me that the metric has to be annihilated by this operator. This is just some first order differential equation for these metric components in this particular coordinate system. And so I can just integrate it in from the boundary, and this uniquely fixes for me these normal metric components. Okay. So the sort of most substantial statement here is this, the use of this theorem in inverse boundary value problems. Everything else is just some algebra, basically. Okay.
So
oh, yes, go ahead.
Do you have to use Einstein equation? Or?
No. Yeah, I mean, this. I should emphasize this. This is a completely kinematic reconstruction. So I'm not invoking any bulk dynamics, any equations of motion that the metric obeys. I'm just saying, give me some geometry. In fact, this is even arbitrary signature. If I know the areas of these surfaces and their variations, I can recover the geometry in this way. With that said, my whole motivation was holographic. I want to think about this in the context of ADS CFT. The HRT formula assumes the bulk gravitational dynamics are Einstein, or obey Einstein's equations. Okay? So you could say that implicitly by invoking areas instead of some other entropy functional, I'm assuming Einstein dynamics in the bulk. And that's certainly true.
The thing that puzzles me is that, metric has 10 independent components. Four of them are gauge, so there's mm-hmm. six components. Mm-hmm. And this function, you have this area, the function of lambdas and x's is one function. And I guess let's say extremality is another condition, which is like...
I know the areas of arbitrary shapes of surfaces. So given any region on the boundary, I know the area of the corresponding HRT surface. So in fact, that's far more information than just some, you know, 10 metric components. And in fact, based on that general counting, you should expect this problem to be hugely overdetermined, because I have access to far more information in the boundary than I'm trying to recover in the bulk. And indeed, we see that explicitly. You get some overdetermined system, which is just the statement that if I give you some arbitrary entanglement data on the boundary, that should not correspond to some geometric bulk, generically. Okay. Good. So for the mixed metric components, here I'll go a little faster because this isn't as fun. I take my original foliation, I tweak it slightly. So here I'm imagining taking my initial foliation and extending it to some one parameter foliation of surfaces. Again, all of these surfaces, solid and dashed, are extremal. That means that the deviation vector associated with this deformation in S has to obey the Jacobi equation. And moreover, these new surfaces define for me some new coordinate system. So I'm calling all these new coordinates sub S, which are related to each other precisely by this deviation vector. So here if I express the relationship between these coordinate systems to linear order in S, the relationship between the lambdas is given by this deviation vector. And then you can just sort of plug and chug a little bit. Say, well, I just argued that given some foliation, I can recover the normal metric components, the GIJs. Well, I can do that with these GSs for any S, if I'd like. Expand this to first order in S. And you get some equation, which the D's of which don't matter at all. In fact, you should basically just look at this equation below the brackets. I have a bunch of stuff that's known based on this argument I gave. This depends on normal components of the metric, equaling some linear combination of these unknown objects, which include the metric components I want. You can do some simple counting, and you find that in four greater bulk dimensions, the number of independent equations in the system is enough, in fact, more than enough, hence this overdetermined property, to recover all of these unknown metric functions. And the system is invertible. And so you can just get them. And I should mention briefly, the D equals 3 case is a lot harder. The counting doesn't work out, and you need to do a lot more work to actually get these metric components. Okay. And then finally, the only remaining degree of freedom was this conformal factor. And here you finally use the extremality condition of these surfaces. The fact that they're extremal implies for you that the conformal factor has to obey some linear PDE, where this F is some known function of the metric components that I already assumed I knew, already sort of argued that I can recover. And then I just integrate this in by sort of constructing some appropriate surface on which to treat it. So here, what I'll consider is Say I want to recover the conformal factor on some particular surface sigma in my foliation. Well, what I'll do is construct some periodic cycle in these parameters, which basically corresponds to moving the boundary of the surface around and then bringing it back to where it started. So here I'm drawing these dotted lines to sort of depict how I'm moving this boundary around and then bringing it back. The bulk surfaces corresponding to this deformation sweep out some tube in the bulk. Okay, this is a three-dimensional surface. I can think about this equation as some 3D PDE on this surface. And then I can just integrate it in from the boundary for this conformal factor. I know the conformal factor on the boundary. That's part of my boundary data. This is a hyperbolic equation. Hyperbolic equations have a well-posed initial value problem. They give me a unique solution. And therefore, this gives me phi everywhere in this tube, and therefore everywhere on this surface sigma that I was interested in. Okay? And now I'm done. That's basically the heart of the argument and all the key steps. And now I'd just like to make some sort of comments or point out some features of this construction or of this result. Okay? So I already pointed out, because it was asked, that while this applies to any two-dimensional surfaces in an arbitrary dimension in space-time, or even space, signature doesn't matter, for holographic interest, of course, we care about the four-dimensional case, because it's in that case that these two-dimensional surfaces are HRT surfaces. Now, I also mentioned this already. The system of equations, or the systems of equations that you get in this procedure, are highly overdetermined, which is exactly what you'd expect on general grounds. You have access to far more information in the boundary than the sort of 10 metric components that you're trying to recover in the bulk. And so the way you might spin this is to say, well, the consistency of this overdetermined system just has to be a necessary condition for the existence of some classical bulk with some particular entanglement structure. Okay? It's a very implicit condition, but that's sort of a natural way to interpret this overdetermined property. Okay? And then one thing that I want to point out is that here we never actually required knowledge of what the areas of these surfaces are. We only required knowledge of their variations, because that's what we needed to get this Dirichlet-Norman map for the Jacobi operator. Okay? And variations of entropy are much more tractable than entropy itself. Like computing entropy in quantum field theory is notoriously hard. Computing variations of it, as long as there's low enough variations, is a lot more tractable. So this is sort of a nice feature that makes this yeah, it's a nice feature. Okay. And then, of course, I should ask, well, OK, cool. How much of the bulk can I actually probe in sort of interesting bulks? Well, you can certainly probe inside black holes. So if I consider, say, the thermofield double state, or perturbations of it, if you'd like, where I have two CFTs living on the asymptotic boundaries of some black hole connected by a wormhole, well, if I consider the entanglement entropy between or other region that consists of some portion in each CFT, then the corresponding HRT surfaces, at least at small enough times, go through the wormhole. And they obey this foliation property that I mentioned by just deforming the boundaries appropriately. And so this argument applies to sort of the region in a neighborhood of these surfaces in the bulk. So you get the interior of these black holes. Not the whole interior, but a portion of it. If you're more interested in an astrophysical black hole, I'm forming a black hole from collapse. So this gray thing is some star, some blob of matter in ADS that I'm collapsing to form a black hole. So some event horizon forms at some time. In a dynamical context like this, I have something like an apparent horizon, which is the surface A I've labeled here, which is basically some local version of an event horizon that seems to have more of a connection with black hole thermodynamics than the event horizon itself. And even in cases like this, at least at early times in the formation of this black hole, HRT surfaces corresponding to some subregions of the boundary can indeed probe inside the black hole, and in fact can even probe inside the apparent horizon. So this is pictures like this you'll see a lot in analyses of quantum quenches in holography, because that's the case where you form a black hole by throwing a bunch of stuff together. Okay, so this is great. This probes a lot more of the bulk than any other existing method can. But of course, you're still bound to stay away from singularities for the reason I mentioned earlier. HRT surfaces just don't like to go that close to singularities. It's a bit disappointing because that's sort of the most interesting gravitational region of the bulk. But it's something you should have expected just from the general structure of HRT surfaces.
A limit to how close they can get to singularity?
I don't know in general. So in special cases, like for example, the Thornfield double state, there's this Hartmann-Maldacena picture where you consider sort of wormhole penetrating HRT surfaces, and they tend to accumulate on some limiting surface that stays some finite distance away from the singularity. In a general dynamical case, all the cases I know of that where people have done this analysis, the surfaces sort of go penetrate the event horizon, penetrate the apparent horizon at some sort of intermediate time, but then at late times they just live outside and sort of never probe the near singularity region here. But I don't know if anyone studied in complete generality what the constraints on how close they can go to singularities are.
In both cases, the HRT surfaces will also only probe for sort of order thermal time after the collapse or after
exactly.
The thermal field double.
That's right.
So
that's right.
Don't know about, like, scrambling.
Yeah. I mean, you could make them go into a planar black hole at arbitrary late times if I have a planar black hole, so two planar CFTs, and I consider the entanglement entropy of a region that consists of a half plane in both of them. Then there I'm basically forcing the surface to go through. But even there, it still accumulates to some surface a finite distance away from the singularity. And then you certainly can't probe things like firewalls in that case, because that's a Hartle-Hawking state or something. But I still think of this as progress. Okay. And now let me just conclude with some extensions. I'll go through this briefly. Just to point out, okay, this argument we gave is a sort of precise manifestation of the idea that entanglement should reconstruct geometry, and it tells us almost exactly how that should work at an algorithmic level. But it's not completely there because it's still a uniqueness result. And the reason is that there was this key step that I invoked by these mathematicians on inverse boundary value problems to conclude that the Jacobi operator was fixed by this boundary data. This is a uniqueness result. It doesn't tell me how to recover the Jacobi operator. It just says it is unique. Okay. So one of the things we're thinking about now is whether there's some constructive extension of this, which would give me basically an algorithm for saying, you know, here's a bunch of entanglement entropies, plug it into some algorithm, and here's some geometry dual to them. And things look quite promising because these sorts of questions have been thought about before by mathematicians. And there's a very sort of closely related result, which does give you this sort of algorithmic reconstruction. So if I said, instead of considering some general Laplacian with some arbitrary covariant derivative, let me instead consider the operator grad squared plus q, where this grad squared is just a flat space Laplacian on some domain of R2. In this case, it is known how to explicitly recover, say, this potential q from the Dirichlet-Nolan map of this operator. Okay? And indeed, we've like been in correspondence with these mathematicians, and it, you know, there's optimism that you should be able to get the same sort of results for our more general operators. So this is just something that I'd like to do at some point to really sort of finish the story in this classical case. Okay. And with that mentioned, this would finish the story for the classical reconstruction. But remember, my goal was to sort of work my way up this chart. And in particular, the next step I should be worried about is, well, what happens when I move away from this classical limit? What happens when I turn on quantum corrections? And here, we already have a framework ready for dealing with things. So for instance, the first thing I should ask is, well, I have this HRT formula. There are order h-bar corrections. I should incorporate those if I want to generalize this construction. And we know how to do that. There's this Engelhardt-Wall formula, which says, OK, fine. If you want to include some quantum corrections in the bulk, the entanglement entropy of some boundary region is no longer computed just from the area of some surface, but rather from the generalized entropy of what's called a quantum extremal surface. So here the generalized entropy just takes the usual area term and adds to it a contribution from the matter entropy of any fields living outside the surface. So if my surface is here, here's my region R, there's some time slice that's bounded by X and by R, I can define some reduced state of matter fields on that slice. I can compute its von Neumann entropy. That's what this S out is. And this surface curly X is a surface which is basically a stationary point of this generalized entropy. So just as a classical extremal surface leaves the area unchanged to first order if I perturb it slightly, these quantum extremal surfaces leave this generalized entropy functional unchanged to first order if I deform them slightly. Okay. And so with this in hand, I can say, well, OK, I can consider the same construction again. And I can say, OK, fine, take this foliation of surfaces. Instead of having them be classical extremal surfaces, have them be quantum extremal surfaces. Now I care about controlling the sort of infinitesimal deformation between these quantum extremal surfaces. And Netta Engelhardt and I sort of studied this exact problem. Now what happens is that because this matter entropy term is not a local geometric functional, in other words, what that means is that if I have some surface, if I want to compute the deformation of this entropy as I perturb the surface somewhere, that deformation or that perturbation of the entropy cares about what the surface is doing everywhere. If I have some surface and I compute the deformation of its area as I perturb it here, it just cares about the perturbation. This matter entropy cares about the structure of the surface everywhere else. So what this means is that when you consider these infinitesimal perturbations to get something like a quantum-corrected Jacobi equation, you get some integral differential equation, where this integral sort of encodes this non-locality. And here, you don't have to understand the sort of details of this expression. The basic idea is that you have some second functional derivative of this matter entropy term, and you integrate this over the full surface, and that encodes for you this non-local property. And then here, this is just the sort of classical Jacobi operator pieces. And then you look at this and you say, well, I still have something that's a second derivative of this deviation vector, plus some junk. Let me just take the classical curvature contribution, throw it in to this integral, and think of this Q tilde, which combines these curvature corrections or curvature contributions and these entropy pieces, as some distributional potential. Okay. And now I can ask the question, well, if I know the Dirichlet to Neumann map for an object like this, or some appropriate notion of boundary data for an object like this, can I recover this derivative operator and this distributional potential, just as I can in the classical case? If you can, you can just go through the argument and generalize it to include sort of these quantum effects, this distributional sense. Okay, so this is one of the things we're also thinking about right now and are talking to some mathematicians about. Great, so with that said, I'm just going to wrap up perfectly. So I told you that for a 4D classical bulk, the bulk geometry in some neighborhood of an HRT surface is uniquely fixed by area deformations of that surface and surfaces in some neighborhood of it that foliate that neighborhood. And the connection is a very nice one with this field of inverse boundary value problems in the math community. To actually start moving up this flowchart that I showed you and start sort of quantitatively studying quantum gravity effects, the two most pressing sort of extensions that need to be focused on are, well, making this fully explicit by filling in this one remaining hole and including these perturbative quantum corrections that I just described. We already have a framework for both of this, so this is just stuff we're working on now. But if anyone has any ideas, I'd be happy to talk. Now, there's this remaining question that I alluded to, which is not quite related to this particular approach to reconstruction, but it's one that one should still have in mind when you're talking about recovering the geometry from entanglement, which is that, well, in principle, ADS-CFT tells me that the full bulk should be dual to the boundary. So even if there are portions of the bulk that HRT surfaces don't reach, those portions should still be recoverable somehow from the boundary theory, boundary state. What is it in the boundary theory that recovers those? I'm not saying I have an answer to this. I'm saying one should definitely think about this and not get sort of lost in the details of just thinking about these surfaces. And then there's a list of generalizations you can make. So as Jeff asked, you know, you might be interested in trying to extend to codimension 2 surfaces in higher dimension. You might be interested in incorporating higher curvature corrections in the bulk, where the HRT formula is modified to some other geometric functional that's not just the area. And then you might be interested in understanding precisely how generic this assumption of there being a foliation is. are there portions of the bulk that HRD services reach, but that you can't reconstruct in this way because this foliation assumption is broken, and a whole bunch of others that would be interesting to think about at some point. So with that said, I'll stop there. Thank you all for listening, and I'm happy to answer any questions. It depends. I mean, every step could fail because every step is an overdetermined system. So, for instance, okay. So, presumably, this is an overdetermined system. I mean, this result is a uniqueness result, so I don't know in what way it's overdetermined, but it probably is. So, once you have an explicit constructive approach, then you could identify how this would fail. But then, even in these other approaches, this linear system of equations is highly overdetermined. So it could just be an inconsistent system of equations, then that's no good. And here, so here I constructed a particular surface on which to evolve this hyperbolic equation. But this equation has to be consistent no matter what surface I evolve it on. And moreover, here I'm treating it sort of like a boundary value problem where I specify phi at the boundary and then evolve it inwards. I can do that, but if I did that for generic initial data, the solution will become singular somewhere. So requiring it to be regular, besides just consistent with every possible tube I could construct, is also one of these constraints on the boundary data.
Other questions? I had a question. Well, it's sort of maybe two parts. One is, okay, you said that HRT surfaces tend to be singularity avoiding.
Yeah.
But so if you're in D greater than 4, you're mm-hmm. actually working with 2D surfaces. Do you mm-hmm. know if those are more likely to approach the singularity than the HRT surface?
I don't. Okay. But I'm sure you could, let's see, could I say some words about, I could probably try to say some words, but they might well be wrong, so I won't.
I guess the other related question is the 2D external surfaces are supposed to have some connection to Wilson lines.
Yeah. So we talked about that extensively, and I didn't mention that at all in the talk for a reason, which is that so there are these other connections between extremal surfaces of other dimension and boundary operators. So Wilson loops and two-dimensional extremal surfaces, or two-point functions of heavy operators and geodesics. My understanding is that those dualities or those elements of the dictionary only hold in very special states. So for example, the geodesic approximation certainly requires the bulk to be very special. It does not hold in a general geometry. We know plenty of examples where it's broken. I think that has to be true also for the Wilson loops. And so those aren't elements of the dictionary I would trust to recover a general geometry. They're certainly not as robust as HRT.
I guess I have a little bit of open-ended question, which you don't have to answer, which is, I mean, how can this, for example, help us address the information paradox, or can it?
Oh, I mean, this alone stays away from firewalls, it stays away from the event horizons of very old evaporating black holes.
What do you mean by it stays away from firewalls?
So firewalls are expected to, so if firewalls happen, they're expected to happen near the event horizon of an old black hole after the page time. That's way beyond the thermal scale after which these surfaces stop probing the event horizon. So when I show this picture, here I'm showing very early times when these HRT surfaces are able to probe the region around the black hole, or inside the black hole or around the horizon. At the very late times past the page time, that's way after these surfaces have stopped probing the interior of the black hole.
Do they probe like a scrambling time or not? Do you know
that? I don't know, but even if you could probe a scrambling time in a young black hole, that's certainly not as interesting in probing a scrambling time around an old black hole.
But I mean, there is a statement in firewall papers that if black holes are fast as scrambling as firewalls would form within a scrambling time. It's just because they would probe the entire Hilbert space within a scrambling time. So it would still be interesting, but I guess I want to say they probably do probe the scrambling time.
I don't know. I haven't thought about it. I mean, that should be easy enough to check and just do. Yeah, yeah.
Any final questions? If not, let's thank Sebastian again.
Cool. Thank you.